When did you start bringing everything downstairs, just so you don't have to go back upstairs again? Joint Relief Institute. Move better, live better without surgery. Call 708-888-0000.
Hey, Steve Bertrand here. Welcome to Steve Bertrand on Books. I want to introduce you today, or maybe reintroduce you today, to novelist Charles Finch. He has a detective series set in Victorian England. It's about this guy, Charles Lennox, who's from a well-to-do family, and he is a member of parliament at one time in the series, but he sort of chucks it because he wants to be a PI. And it's not a very respected position or job in Victorian England, but he pursues it. Anyway, I love this series because it really teaches me a lot about how the Victorians lived and the sort of social standards and things like that. There's detective stuff too, obviously, but it's about a lot more than that. So we'll talk to Charlie coming up. Also today, are you one of those people who has a hard time putting a book down? You start it and then you kind of feel guilty when you don't finish it. It kind of like you're letting the author down. I feel that way. Sophie Virchow has written a piece for The Atlantic, and she talks about when it's okay to set a book down. It turns out she has a hard time doing that too.
I do have this issue. I worked in book publishing for about a decade, and I feel some sort of just inherent, I want to read everything, but I have gotten better at it. I do put books down now.
Okay, we'll kick that around a little bit later. But first, let's say hello to Charles Finch. He was a one-time East Coaster, lived in Chicago briefly, and now he is soaking up the sun in Los Angeles. Charles, welcome.
Thank you so much, Steve. Wonderful to be here.
Yeah, it's great to be here with you. You know, you and I have talked several times over the years, and I was so happy to see there was a new Charles Lennox book out last year. Number 12, right?
It is. Gosh, let me think. It's 12, but there are also three prequels. So it's technically number 15, believe it or not.
Oh, interesting. And yeah. You're not always at it, are you? Or tell me, it doesn't seem like...
I did one a year for, I want to say, 14 years, and then the pandemic came, and I wrote two books in 1 year. I wrote the last of the mysteries before The Hidden City, which was called An Extravagant Death, and I wrote a book called What Just Happened, which I think you read, I remember. And it was a journal about COVID, and after that, I was just fried. Yeah. And so I took a year or two off, and I wrote some other stuff, did some, you know, kind of soul searching. And then I was ready and I came back to it. And the result is sort of, I guess, a 3-year layoff. But I feel pretty invigorated now.
You know, I was going to bring up What Just Happened a little bit later. It was kind of a memoir of the pandemic. And I want to know, does it still have life? Because I would think that it would even be growing in popularity because we forget what happened.
You're completely right. Like, it was a book that, it came out at the time and it got a good critical response. It got really nice reviews in like the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Chicago Tribune. But I think a lot of people, even my friends, were like, this looks great. I'm going to buy it and read it in 10 years. Because I think we were all so traumatized by the... But now, as time passes, obviously it's been what? I mean, it's coming up on 6 years since that March when we locked in. This is, by the way, for your listeners, a day-by-day account of COVID for the first year. Now I'm starting to get letters that are like, I wasn't ready to think about this until now, but it brought back so much. It was incredibly cathartic. It was, so I think I knew as I was writing it, that it was maybe a book that would winter a little bit. Like I didn't expect it to, I myself wasn't ready to read about COVID or watch movies about COVID. And now as the years pass, I notice it getting more and more fans who are like really passionate about it. Maybe more than any of my other books, to be honest.
That's fantastic. I think that, do you know the historian Frederick Lewis Allen?
No, I don't think I do.
He was back in the 30s, but he wrote a book in, I think, 1929, and it was called Since Yesterday. And, you know, it's one of those things, and I know you'll have books that just stay with you forever, right? That one I read when I was maybe in high school or college, and it's always stayed with me because it was a recapturing of the 20s and the different phases that we went through and things like the hula hoop and all of this stuff, you know? And you sort of have, since yesterday, when it comes to 1 year, with a more personal account, it was kind of a memoir as well.
Yeah, it was both. I mean, I was trying to record what was happening. And of course, that was leading up to, you know, the election between Trump and Biden. And also just like things like, you know, going back to grocery stores, masking up for the first time when there were not enough masks to go around, like the daily events. And then also what it was like to just be inside alone with my music and my thoughts and my family, which we all went through. I mean, that book sounds great. Does it culminate in 1929 as an ominous year? Does it culminate in
Yeah, that's true. Okay, let's go further back to Victorian England with Charles Lennox. And I want to ask you, I've read your answer before, so don't answer me until I'm done. But I'm interested in why it is that the Victorian era is so popular when it comes to movies and writing. And it occurred to me when I was reading Phil Mellinson's book this year, last year. I don't know if you know that one, Florenzer.
Yeah.
Set in the Renaissance. And it's like, well, these two are kind of, not that they're similar, but they are kind of a focus for popular culture. You know, why do you think that is?
Well, I think that the Renaissance is actually a really apt comparison, because I do think there are these moments in history when a new culture takes shape pretty quickly. And, you know, for thousands of years, life had been kind of the same in a way. And then, or at least 1,000 years, I guess you could argue. And then the Renaissance happened, and there was this huge loosening of like religious strictures, of like restrictions on art and marriage and things like that. And Victorian England is kind of the same. It's like, you know, the invention of the ball bearing and the steam engine and it's all of this stuff at once, while taking place in this extremely interesting, intricate society of manners and of very exact social mores and of a strict caste system. So something about that, I think, is pretty irresistible. And it's also close enough in history that it feels a lot like us while being very different.
Mm-hmm. I enjoy it because, and we'll get to it, because you were very good at dropping in little nuggets of this is happening or that is happening, and including Swedish gymnasiums. But before that, let's set up the story a little bit. Lennox, of course, is a former member of parliament. He's from a higher class in London, and he leaves parliament to become a PI, private investigator, which was looked down upon, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, this was an era when if you were a member of the upper class or the aristocracy, even to become a doctor was considered very lower class because you have to use your hands when you're a doctor. And so for Lennox to become a private investigator would have been completely shocking and unacceptable to everyone around him. And so we're used to, you know, a Victorian England full of Sherlock Holmeses, but in fact, it would have been a pretty surprising new revolutionary idea—the idea of having someone do this job—and in a way, that sums up my whole relationship with the Victorian period, which is we think of it as so stuffy and so I don't know, strict. But in fact, it was this time of huge upheaval and change, and to them, it felt extremely strange. And so, I like playing with that duality.
The name of the book is The Hidden City, and one of the earlier characters comes back as well, Mrs. Huggins, right? Mrs. Huggins, who kind of led Charles around by his ear, even if he didn't know it. When she was his housekeeper, she moves away and she comes back and she's in trouble.
That's exactly right. Well, as the book starts, it follows on from the previous book, An Extravagant Death, and he had been stabbed at the end of that book. And some novel series tend to just put the character right back where they were at the start of the last book every time. If you think about like Agatha Christie, it's like it always sort of starts back where you were. I like to let the characters evolve a little more over time. And so this book, I have Charles at the start really struggling with his recuperation from this stabbing. Like, I wanted to acknowledge that happened. We don't just like reset. It's not all sunshine and rainbows. And the only thing that can sort of drag him back to work is the call of Mrs. Huggins on his loyalties, which is his housekeeper from 20 years before when he first lived in London. And she is worried because she has rented out an apartment, which is beautiful and nice and close to family, but happens to have been the site of a murder 7 years before she got there. And she's worried that something is going to happen again. And so he sort of rouses himself out of his convalescence, and the case kind of cures him in a way.
Okay. In the previous book, you talk about the fact that he was stabbed. He was stabbed in the United States.
That's right.
It's the first book where Lennox goes to the U.S. and you stab him. Did that?
I know.
Behind that.
You know, it was funny that that was an interesting book to write. It's set in Newport, Rhode Island, which I've actually never been to, but I did a ton of research, read books about it. And I wanted like a really serious antagonist. And at that time we were talking about Victorian London. America was like Victorian London on steroids. There were these like billionaire equivalents who were completely ruthless and completely, I don't know if it sounds topical or not, but completely ruthless and acquisitive. And I wanted Lennox to run into one of those because it was something that I've never been able to explore about Victorian London, where it's much more likely that your wealth comes from your great, 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 great grandparents or something like that. So I wanted him to encounter this new type of person who was emerging over in the States. And the violence seemed to make a little bit of sense in that context to me.
Okay. So then he comes back to Great Britain. He's recovering, Mrs. Huggins calls. And while he's working her case, he gets very sick for a time. And you tell me if I'm wrong, but he gets sick and the doctors recommend one thing and he ends up doing something sort of surreptitiously completely opposite and he gets better. Was that a comment on the medicine of the day compared to what we know now, or was that just a coincidence, or tell me?
Absolutely. You're really zeroed in on something that I was thinking about, even though it's not explicit in the text, which is I was reading something, I think, as I was writing it about, it was a sort of like an article, it might have been in the New Yorker, about what was the last year that, or the first year that doctors, that if you went to the doctor, on average, they would help you. And it's shockingly recent. It's like something like, you know, because of course there was bloodletting and all of these quack cures that they were very sure about. And so in this book, I mean, it was something like, you know, 1910 or something. I mean, surgery has been pretty good for about a half a millennium now. So surgery, they've always been able to take off an arm and sew you up, stuff like that. But in terms of medicine, in this book, they're like, well, you're sick. You need absolute bed rest. And he starts sneaking out and walking the city. And it's that actually cures him, the opposite of what they said. And it was maybe a wry commentary on doctors and their air of infallibility.
I'll give you that. You had a little point on there, a little arrow with that too, not just an observation. Okay, let's go to the gym. This fascinates me. So, and this is carries us to modern day, I guess, as well. But I did not know that the Victorians started going to the gym and working out with Swedish guys.
Yeah, neither did I. And actually, that was like maybe. I mean, you know, if I have to think about what led me into this book, like after 15 books, I know a lot about Victorian London, and yet there's just always some new wrinkle or permutation to discover. And this time, one of them I discovered was I like to read old Victorian newspapers, and I saw an advertisement for a drug in it over and over in these Victorian newspapers called Mother's Helper. And It said the number one drug in England and the most popular, whatever. And it said it will cure your baby's toothache, it will help your baby sleep or whatever. And then in fine print at the bottom, it says, made of the finest cannabis, morphine, and cocaine. And so, of course, every baby who had any of that was immediately going to be much calmer. But that led me into The Murder, which is about an apothecary. And then similarly, I was reading about fads at the time. And to my real astonishment, I saw that one of the fads was this newfangled invention called the gymnasium. And it turns out that all of these nutty Swedish people came over and they opened up these gymnasia, and they were sort of laughed at for about a year or so. And then suddenly the entire aristocracy was competing to get into these places, and they would do the pommel horse and boxing and get massages. And it was really the start of what we have now. And the guy who started it actually, started the precursor of the modern Olympics as well. So the first kind of like glimmers of the fitness era were beginning in the middle of Victorian London, of all places.
We're talking to Charles Finch, is the author of several books featuring Charles Lennox, but the most recent is The Hidden City. And okay, so we've got the medicine, we've got the gyms, we've got the beginning of the suburbs.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You're so good at picking up on these little details, Steve. Yes, the this the sort of pattern, I was talking a little bit earlier about how industrialization was changing the face of Great Britain. And in that case, there was a little bit more money rattling around. And so for a long, long time, it had been like, well, either you live on some rich guy's land and pick his potatoes, or you live in the city and live in a tenement. But now there was a little bit more money and it was distributed just a little more evenly. And every Englishman sort of had the dream of a home that was his own castle. And so on the outskirts of London, there started to pop up these long rows of houses that look like miniature castles. They look like, you know, but, and they're, of course, now what we have all over our country, America, they're subdivisions of land. But at the time, it was extremely novel. And so Lennox at one point goes out to one and he's astonished to see, well, these aren't apartment buildings or great estates. They're this in-between thing where you get half an acre of land and you have your own little private garden, but it's for the sort of middle class. And so it's the very, very birth of what we think of as the middle class, which had never really existed.
Did Lennox look down on it a little bit?
I think Lennox is a funny case because he's probably to an anachronistic degree pretty enlightened. He's curious, you know, he's a detective and he's curious about, like, he's not passing judgment. But I think a lot of people were like, well, society is going to hell. You can tell because all these people think they have the right to have their own little castle. And of course, we look back on the height of the middle class in the 50s and 60s as a real golden age in some ways. Like, you could have one parent making a living and supporting a family of five and own your own home and a car and go on 2 weeks of vacation every year. But at the time, it was considered, well, these poor people are getting uppity, or, you know, it's a monstrosity on the landscape, and the hedgerows are being torn down. So someone's always complaining about anything that's happening, I guess, is the lesson.
Well, that certainly is everlasting.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've got healthcare, we've got gymnasia, we've got all of them. I'm not going to get to suffrage, but that is comes up in here as well, which is fascinating. But you talked about uppity, and you take on or you point out the caste system here a little bit as well. Lennox's niece comes from India with her half sister, who is half Indian, and she's a real go-getter, and she's going to have trouble just because of the color of her skin in Victorian England, which she probably would today in 21st century America in some circles too.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was a really interesting character to write. And again, it was based in the research. Like, I, you know, a lot of people ask about research. And I think when I started out the series 15 years ago, I would read these long books that were historical about, you know, what was the price of corn from 1 year to the next? What was this? And now it's more about the details. And I think I saw a detail about a young Indian woman who was sort of the toast of society one season because she was very beautiful. She was from a high-born family. She had been sort of half adopted into a British family. And I thought, gosh, what an interesting little point of friction between Lennox's world and then these very conservative forces at work in society at the time, like the grandmothers being shocked and scandalized as their grandsons chased after this young Indian girl. So I just thought, it was a subject that I dealt with race maybe once or twice before in a book called The Last Passenger. I wrote about an American freed slave who came to America, or came to England, excuse me, and was delivering a lecture series. But I had never had a really central character where the issue of race was something I could write about. And it ended up being just an incredibly rich vein for reading about Victorian attitudes to race, which were much more complicated than we would imagine. It wasn't just like, you know, I mean, at the same time, you know, there were Black and Indian students at Harvard and Yale and Oxford and Cambridge. It was all much more fluid than it seems in retrospect, I would say.
Well, we talked last week about the science of reading, and if you're having trouble to find something comfortable with and things like that, and your series, Lennox, certainly is that for me. You know, when I'm struggling. No, it's true. Because you know, I just feel a little bit at home. I enjoy it a lot. And I want to move on a little bit, but I wanted to ask you earlier and I forgot. Where did you, so we're going, let's go back to the gym. Okay. We're getting a massage or whatever it is that Lennox is getting. Where did you learn to, or how did you approach writing with the Swedish accent?
That's so funny. I was for sure faking it. I mean, I think I just, what I really do is I sit there at my desk and I have my coffee and I try to like say it how I would say it and then type it out kind of phonetically and hope it's like, you know, anytime you use a foreign accent like that, you're hoping for a little bit of a chuckle from the reader.
Yes.
And you know, they miss prepositions and they use adjectives wrong. And so you try to sprinkle in some of that. And so it's really one of those things where the writer, it can't be research. It has to be the music you hear, you know, and every writer is different in that way.
How do you take the critics' accounts of your books, the reviews?
That's a really interesting question. Well, I'm so grateful for how the series is generally received. I think it tends to get a lot of reviews that say, like, you know, the world is very vivid and, you know, Victorian London comes to life. And I'm really grateful for those. They're on the back of the book and they really matter. But when I actually hear from readers, I think it's much more about, they're written in the close third person, which means that you're always with Lennox. You're always near him. And I think the readers find him companionable and decent. And so there's a sense in which I think critics who maybe are coming in for one book or have read a couple books, but not for a while, tend to say like, wow, look at this depiction of Victorian London, or look at this. And whereas maybe the readers who, I get letters every day from readers who are like, I've read the series four times, or I read the, one thing I hear a lot is I read this with my father as he was dying and it brought us both joy, or, you know, very serious moments in people's lives, they need comfort. And there's something really comforting that I experienced, you know, from Sherlock Holmes and Patrick O'Brien. And I mean, I could go on and on, all these about being very close to a series over a lot of chapters in someone's life. And so I think there's a little bit of a gap between how the critics read the books and how the readers read the books, which is to be expected. I mean, I'm a critic and I can acknowledge that as well. But it's interesting to observe.
Yeah, I want to get to your criticism, but you bring up a great point. And, you know, I just recently went through retirement, sort of. Here we are. But I was astounded by the impact I had on some people or the stories they told me. Just like, and it's a great feeling, isn't it, when you hear that or told that. So it's kind of the lesson I took out of that, and you probably carried it as well, is to share those ideas with other people. Because you just don't know what impact you have on others until they tell you. You can't assume it. So I asked you about why you took, how you took criticism, because you're a critic, right? And I couldn't, you're holding a lot of weight in your hands, a lot of power.
Yes, that is very well put. You are holding a lot of power and weight, and someone can go write a book for 2 or 3 years or 10 years, and you have 800 words or 1200 words, and you can be really cruel. And so it's something to take very seriously, because at the same time, your duty is not to the writer, it's to the reader of the review, to let them know, what is this book about? What is it trying to accomplish? Should I read it? What is it? And so it's really a matter of principle and honor. And it sounds very highfalutin, but to me, I really feel that. And I think that having written hundreds of reviews for huge places and doing it over and over, the thing I've realized is that what you have to do, as far as my own principles are concerned, I mean, I think every critic is different, is you have to get to the writer's, you know, you have to play on their side of the field. You have to get to their 10-yard line, you know, you have to like,
right, it's their story,
their book. And you have to be like, what are they trying to do? I'm not going to judge this about how I feel about their subject. Like, they wrote a book about Marco Polo and I don't care about that. Or they wrote a novel, you know, about this and I don't care about it. You have to really inhabit them. And then once you've done that and given them a really fair read on their own terms, you have to be completely merciless and honest and candid, because that's the only way your reader will trust you. And so it's almost like a two-step. It's like you have to be incredibly generous to the author and then put that to the side and say things that could hurt the author. And I feel confident about very little as a writer. I mean, I think all writers are like that, but I feel extremely confident that that is the honorable path for a critic. That's what I would say.
Do you ever hear from the authors?
Yes. And, you know, it's funny. Sometimes you hear from the authors and they're pissed off. Sometimes you hear from the authors and they're really nice, but it turns out they're pissed off. So I learned a long time ago that I tend to give the authors 2 or 3 months and then I'll respond and I'll say like, look, I know you said you loved the review, but I'm just responding a little late, because in the past, sometimes they say they love it and then you write back, oh, thank you. And then they say, but, and then they have a long litany and turns out they're angry. And listen, I do both things. I'm a creator and a critic, and my creator side, I completely get it. And I think like I would never write to a critic because I think there's no battle to be won there. But there have been times when, sure, I would have loved to, you know.
Ever take one on it? Want to take one back?
A review?
Yeah.
What a great question. I'll tell you the answer. There's one review I wrote of an author who I adore, Toni Morrison. And she was, I opened the book. It was one of her very last. She died shortly afterward. I opened it and it was not great, as people's final works often are not. Like, you know, often in the last, you know, few years, the novelist's power wanes. Like I think of Philip Roth's power fell apart, people like that. And in a way, I reviewed the book a little bit dishonestly because I was such a passionate, ardent fan of some of her work. Sula is one of my favorite novels, and there are others. And so I kind of, that was the only time where I turned it in. And a couple of days later, I was like, you know, I was not honest. And to me, honesty, I mean, really, truly, the answer is I'm a disciple of Orwell, who's like, you have to say exactly what is the truth. You have to say it simply and clearly. And that was the one time, and I haven't even thought about it in years, but that is the single time out of the hundreds of reviews I've written where I, a day or two later, I might have taken it back.
Oh, that's a pretty good record. Before you go, we've been talking for years.
That's not to say, I mean, I've been mistaken many times.
No, I get that, yeah. But we've been talking for years, and one of the things that struck me was when you moved to Chicago and you came into the studio and you're like, yeah, it's the people in New York and Chicago are really different. You know, like, do you remember that? The people in Chicago are really nice, right?
It's the absolute truth. I mean, I think the people of New York, you know, it's complicated. I think like I lived in Boston for most of high school. I was at boarding school, and there the people are kind of jerks. And after two or three years, you figure out that that's actually who they are. They're bitter. It's cold all the time. They're whatever. New York people can be really abrasive and thoughtless, but there's a real warmth and sense of community. And then in Chicago, Chicago is just unlike anywhere I've ever lived. And I was telling you before we started recording, like I live in California now, and I partly moved because of the winters, which no longer seem to be as big a problem. I moved after the polar vortex, and it just about killed me. And so but what I miss most about Chicago is just, you know, other places you invite people over for dinner or something and they'll bring you a bottle of wine. And in Chicago, it's like, well, I made you a casserole. Here's two bottles of wine and a six pack. Here's a dessert. And I also brought over this extra rice cooker for you, or, you know, whatever it might be. Like there's a warmth and a profuseness of spirit that I still miss to this day about Chicago.
You might think of that as nice, but that's just because we don't trust your cooking.
No, I can think of other examples too. I can think of other examples that are not food based.
But I bring it up because now you're in LA. You've been in LA for a number of years. So you've got New York, Chicago, LA. Let's go back to grade school, compare and contrast. Where does LA fit in there?
I mean, LA is really has its own beauty as well, which is that I think people here are incredibly accepting and open-minded, and that maybe in the places where, you know, a lot of people are coming out here to stake their chance on something. They're creative, or they're, you know, trying to accomplish something. And it's still the West. It's still fluid. Whereas in New York and Chicago, the buildings are the buildings, and sometimes that drives me crazy. Sometimes I miss that feeling of the old world sitting within it. But I think people here in general, I mean, you see the crazy side of it, which is they'll believe anything about Scientology or wellness or whatever. But you also see like the real openness of spirit of like it's a very accepting place. And I mean, it's a very open-hearted place in terms of maybe Chicago, I would say, is more generous, but LA is maybe more accepting in some way. Like, I think there is a sense when I moved to Chicago of like, who's this new stranger who's living? You know, there is a sort of like, well, let's give it a minute and see how he is.
Yeah. Charles Finch, the latest book in the Charles Lennox series is Hidden City, The Hidden City. And I don't know how many times we've talked, but I enjoy it every time. And I appreciate you making time for me today, Charlie.
Likewise, Stephen. Congratulations on the retirement, although you seem very not retired to me doing the podcast and all your trips. So I wish you continued success with all of these incredible ventures of yours. And I love talking. Thank you so much for supporting us authors and for reading the books and for actually asking questions about the book, which is not always the case. So I'm grateful.
That's Charles Finch. His latest is The Hidden City. You're listening to Steve Bertrand on Books. Okay, maybe you don't do this, maybe you do. I feel like a lot of us do. You pick up a book, you don't really like it, and then you have a hard time setting it aside, right? I do that all the time. I feel like I'm a failure if I don't finish a book. And even worse is when I don't finish a book, I keep it around. And so it's just like, I look at it like it's a bit of a failure on my part. Sophie Verspo wrote about that in The Atlantic, and she joins us now. Okay, Sophie, put your book down, put it aside, and say hello.
Hi. Very nice to be joining you today.
I'm glad you are. Do you have this issue?
I do have this issue. I worked in book publishing for about a decade, and I feel some sort of just inherent need and respect for the author, and I want to read everything, but I have gotten better at it. I do put books down now.
You know, I think that's part of it. I feel like I owe the author something.
Exactly.
I do feel like it's kind of a failure on my part. Okay, so you went out, you talked to people in the book world, in the reading world about when it's okay to chuck a book, and it sounds like there's really no consensus out there.
You know, with a topic like this, there's technically no right or wrong answer, and ultimately people should really just do what they want to do when it comes to a hobby like this. But I do think that there are some guiding principles that you can really use, and I heard from a lot of people, especially who are educators, English teachers, and I thought that a lot of them especially had some really good advice around investigating why you want to put a book down. Is it simply bad writing? Is it completely just not interesting to you? Or is it something taking you out of your comfort zone where it would actually be really good for you to hear, you know, a new perspective or something? There's just so many reasons one might put a book down.
Yeah, I want to pursue this a little bit. So, and you know, maybe it involves some psychoanalysis on my part, but I should look at maybe why I don't like the book, and maybe that'll teach me something about myself. Explain that for me.
Yeah, I think that reading is one of those things where we use it to explore lives and experiences other than our own. I think, if I'm remembering correctly, I think I use the example of a book like Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me. Like, there's a big difference between reading that and saying, you know, for me as a white woman, that makes me feel uncomfortable, new mm-hmm. perspectives, I don't want to read it, and picking up a novel at an airport I didn't know anything about, and then saying, wow, I only have one precious life on this world. This book is not teaching me anything. I'm going to move on with my life. So I think it can be book to book a little bit different in what that experience is.
Empathy is a big thing for me, and I feel like we're losing our empathy in this country, or it's become weaponized. And you write about this, and you say that reading a book that upsets you or makes you uncomfortable might actually make you a better person.
Yeah, absolutely. Reading is meant to challenge our perspectives, our perceptions, to learn about new experiences. And I think too, you know, I, as someone who reads quite a bit, I always say I value a new reading experience, honestly, almost above all else. It's pretty rare for me to put down a book that feels completely unique and different and original, even mm-hmm. if it's not my thing, because it feels like a new experience versus saying, ah, this book is doing all the tropes I hate. I don't feel it's well written. I want to move on. But I do ultimately think the most important thing is for people to read. And what I don't want people doing is not reading because they feel they have to finish a book they hate. And so they're not moving on to their next book and they just get stuck. It is more important to read than to feel you have to finish every book you hate and read so much less because of it.
There was a book from, it must have been the 80s or early 90s, The Autobiography of Henry VIII. It was written by Margaret George. And it was, I was in the History Book of the Month Club at the time. And it was a brick. It was like 1,000 pages. It was daunting. I read maybe the first 50-100 pages and I set it down, but I set it down, you know, on my book stand or on my shelf, right where I could see it every day. And it just made me feel like a failure. And then I went back to it a year later or something. And it turns out it's one of the most influential books I've ever read in my life. So had I not gone back to it, I could have ruined my life.
It's true. And I do think that I like to say, just because a book isn't right for you now doesn't mean it's not right for you at some point. I can't tell you how many times that's happened to me where I just pick something up and I am not in the mood for maybe really dense, beautiful literary prose. And I just can't take that on right now. And that's my fault, not the book's. And so I'm a big believer too. And you feel you can't get through something, but it can be of value to you. There's also an opportunity to put things down, move on, read the light, fluffy thing you need for this moment and come back, start again.
So at the library, my library, there's a book club section and I go to look at it. And because it's popular books, right? Everyone's reading them. And maybe I'm just revealing my guilt to you now, but a lot of times I'm not turned on by the idea of the book because they don't necessarily, I don't relate to them. And they're foreign to me, the subjects or the authors. And what we're really saying is that probably should be a reason why I do pick it up.
Yeah, I think in general, we should all be reading as, you know, widely as possible. That is the most exciting and fun part about reading is all of the options. And so I'm always a little bit torn, I have to be honest, when I write about books, because I feel two ways about it. One, which is that, again, I just want people to read. I just want people to read. If you told me that you read 50 romantasy books last year, you contributed to the publishing world 5,000 times more than most people. And that is amazing. But I also think that with all of our, you know, niches of what we love to read, reading widely, again, is one of the best opportunities we have to get that empathy, to learn new ideas, to do all of that. And so if you can read the things that you really love, but also push yourself outside of that box, it's going to just expand your mind and your capacities for empathy so much.
I know a guy who sets a page limit, and let's say it's 50, and he gets to page 50 and he doesn't like it, he just puts it down. He doesn't feel bad about it. I mean, is that a good idea or a bad idea?
That is a personal rule. I talked to a lot of people who had different personal rules. It was interesting. A lot of people said this number chapter, this number page. I think 50 and 100 were, of course, the two most common page counts I heard. But a lot of people put books down. And I will say, too, I am a big library user now. I listen to a lot of audiobooks through the Libby app. And that is, to me, the best encouraging me to feel okay putting a book down, too. And also to experiment, to feel that I can step really outside of my own interest in genres and give tons of things a try without it being so much of a financial commitment.
Is listening to a book the same as reading a book? I mean, does it count?
I think it absolutely counts.
Well, that's because you do it, Sophie. I mean, that's your next thing.
It is because I do it.
You know, we just passed the end of the year and everyone's talking about how many books they read, and it sort of becomes this competitive thing, which I guess isn't a good... Well, let me tell you a story. So I'm in third grade, Miss Lamb. Police class. And so she had a contest for the most book reports you could write in the class. And many of the books were about foreign countries, you know, kids' experiences in foreign countries. They're third grade books. And I loved it. And I love to travel. I think that's Mrs. Lampley. Thank you for that. I think that's one of the reasons I enjoy travel so much now. But here's the thing. There was this girl who I had a crush on, a third grade crush, I know, and she was beating me in the book report contest. And then I found out she wasn't reading the books. She was just reading the back cover synopsis and writing a report. Oh, a third grader's dilemma. What do you do? What do you do?
I am not a big fan of the gamification of reading. I think it's great when people, if you are happy reading hundreds of books a year, that's great. But I don't think it's some sort of great consumerist aspiration to have. You should do that if it brings you joy. And I do sort of like to think the same reason why you might think about putting a book down and why you're doing it. Why are you reading a book you hate? What is the point of it? What are you giving yourself? And I think that in some cases, a lot of people would say, I want to be able to say I finished it. I want to put it on my, you know, ticked off number list. And I might argue that if that is the only reason, perhaps you don't need to finish the book.
Well, if we can go back to 1970 or 72 or whenever it was, I gallantly and gentlemanly kept my mouth closed, of course, because I was hoping that one day love would blossom.
That was very gentlemanly.
So the other thing is, if a book unsettles you or makes you angry, don't walk away from it, because if you walk away from it, it sort of limits your ability to argue against it or against what the writer was saying. Is that the point?
Well, I think that there's a couple of things here. I can't remember the exact phrase, but it's something like, you know, the opposite of love isn't anger, it's apathy. I think there's a really big difference between being super apathetic towards a book and really angry at it. And again, back to that psychological investigation, that to me is an interesting emotion to explore. Why do I hate this book? What is that reaction coming from? And again, the teachers I talked to said they actually use that a lot to explore with their students. So it definitely made me pay more attention to that for sure.
Yeah, explain that for me. You talked to a writer, or a teacher rather, who enjoys it when a student comes up and says they hate this book or they don't like this book. Then they sort of delve into it together. Explain that for me. How does that work?
I've often heard that teachers actually they don't mind you hating the material. They want you to engage with it. And so if anything, it's like, why am I as a person feeling this impulsive engagement with the material? That seems, at least to me, like a thing I would want to keep exploring and get to the rest of the book to try to figure that out more, versus a book where I'm feeling nothing but boredom or mild annoyance. You know, that's maybe not a thing I need to explore as much.
So when you go to someone's house, Sophie, do you look at their bookshelf to see what they've been reading?
Oh, always. Yeah.
So then I was thinking about that too, because when I do finish a book, I put it on a shelf as it's a trophy, a show-off trophy, which is I may be a polluted attitude too. And Sophie, I organize my shelves so the most difficult books are the ones most likely to be seen by people coming to my house.
Right at eye level.
Yeah, right at eye level. Exactly.
I mean, we all have such a complex relationship with intellectual material and the movies or shows that we want to say we've seen, the books we want to have read. I mean, I am completely susceptible to that. You know, if there's some big buzzy book everyone's talking about, I want to know what it is and I want to understand that. And to me, you know, that's just how we all operate. Sure, we can judge ourselves for it, but very few people, I think, are impacted by that in some way.
Sophie Vershaw is a freelance writer, but you got a full-time job, right?
I do.
In social media. And then you do freelance. The article I read was in The Atlantic. And the question was, when is it okay to put down a book? And the definitive answer was, it depends.
It depends. Right?
Okay. So we talk about writing here. And as a freelance writer, how does that work? Do you pitch the publications or do they come to you? Because looking at what you've written, a lot of the top publications in the country.
Yeah, so it's a combination, definitely. When I was a little bit earlier, I was doing all the pitching with very little success. And now it's gotten to a nice place where I'd say it's probably 50-50 editors asking me to write things versus me pitching them.
Okay, so kind of a personal question here. But so you've got a full-time job and you do this freelance writing. I don't know how lucrative it is. Maybe you could tell us, but do you do it for the money or do you do it for the accomplishment or what's your motivating force there?
Yeah, it's so funny. I've been asked this question twice within a week. And so I've had to do some good soul searching for myself on this one, which is, I mean, it probably goes back to a little bit of what we were just talking about where, you know, those bylines mean something to me and it means something to me to be represented in those publications that I respect and have been reading, you know, since I was a kid in a lot of cases. But for me, a lot of my writing specifically on books keeps me connected to the book world. I worked in Big Five legacy publishing for around a decade out of college and loved it. And it meant so much to me. I left for tech for all the reasons that anyone listening can imagine one might make that transition. And I'm very happy with that transition and the life it affords me. But the book world, I just care about and find interesting. And so as much as I sometimes regret taking on things that involve me sitting in the library on the weekends, like, you know, writing, I do really enjoy it.
Do you keep the magazine, the hard copy magazine that you're published in?
I have so rarely been published in print. I think I have 3 print hits in my whole career. And yes, I own several copies of those 3 newspapers.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that because I used to write for the Tribune pieces and columns occasionally, and I kept them all. I cut up these newspaper clippings, a bunch of yellowing paper now. So, I mean, if you want them, I'll send them to you.
Nothing. I don't think that the thrill of being published in print could ever rub off for me. Nothing excites me more than that.
You can hold it. It's something you can hold.
Exactly. Like a book.
Yeah, it's the book, Sophie Vershaw. I enjoyed talking to you very much. The piece is in The Atlantic, and I hope we can talk again.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for the invite.
Okay, that's going to wrap things up for Steve Bertrand on Books in this episode. Thanks very much for tuning in. I hope you tell your friends about it. And if you like something or don't like something or love something, maybe, feel free to let me know. SteveBertrandOnBooks@gmail.com. I'll take all comments, plus and negative, plus are preferred. See you next time. Be well.